Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Daniel Paris. My guest today is Lewis Nelson. He is the author of the just published Mosaic, War, Monument, Mystery. Lewis, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Dad. Thank you. It's good to see you.
So in the interest of full disclosure to everyone, I have to say Lewis is a family friend of many decades standing, and it's a real pleasure to have him on the show to discuss what is a really fascinating book, a combination of topics. It literally is the book itself a mosaic. I'm assuming the title is not accidental. It is a tale that I think everyone will appreciate how it's woven together. The Korean War Veterans Memorial, a memoir of a life very well and interesting, well-lived and an interesting life, a reflection on the history of DC, where the Korean War Veterans Memorial is, and the construction of the Washington and Lincoln and Jefferson Memorials, all woven together. Lewis, this was a big work in many ways. How did this come about, the history of the writing of this particular book?
As truthfully as I could tell you, it came about because I started working on the design of the Korean War Veterans Memorial back in 1990. And the dedication of the memorial happened in 1995. That's a long time ago. And then, so some of the work really started to evolve at that particular time, or some of the words, some of the ideas started to evolve at that time. However, it wasn't until 9/11 that it happened. A couple of people called me, a couple of magazines called me. They wanted a statement about memorials, because a lot of people were talking about doing a memorial in respect to the losses that we had here in New York and in Washington, as well as in Pennsylvania. So I put something together, put some words together, and then I thought that also along with the way, there was a lot of people writing about memorials, and many didn't know what they were talking about, from my point of view anyway, as egotistical as that probably sounds. Because we did an awful lot, I did an awful lot of exploration of what memorials mean, and particularly in the case of the National Mall, because that's where all the memorials that we basically know as most Americans, unless we're in Dothan, Alabama, and there's one to the boll weevil and various other kinds of memorials that are throughout the United States for various and good reasons. Because they mean something to people. And that's the important thing about what a memorial is. It has to do something with either a loss or a commemoration.
So let's stop there just for a second, because I think that's fascinating. The book, as I said, weaves together many of these tales, but the history of memorials and the thinking about memorials is an important component of that. I was trained as a historian. I'm very sensitive to every small town in the United States has the Doughboy Cenotaph. The cenotaph starting the World War I memorials. There are, of course, in many parts of the country, also Civil War memorials. But in every town center, every small town, there is a World War I memorial, which kind of starts the modern, in my mind, starts the modern generation of memorials. And then you provide a really interesting history on the construction of the Washington Monument, the Jefferson and the Lincoln memorials, maybe not in that order, Washington, Lincoln, and Jefferson. and how then really your the Korean War Veterans Memorial and the Vietnam Memorial, you know, differed, and different representations of that. And I think people who attend or see these memorials, whether it's the World War I cenotaph in their own village or come to DC in the mall, I think it's really important that we don't think enough about what do these represent and where did they come from. But the book does a lovely job of kind of characterizing the evolution of memorials over time.
Thanks, Dan. Want me to remark on that?
Please.
It became very important because at the time when we were assigned to do this by the Act of Congress, as a matter of fact, and the Act of Congress was that the memorial must commemorate the service of the men and women who were the soldiers and the sailors and the airmen of the Korean War, not necessarily the commanders, which is major difference, because most every other memorial has to do with who the leader is, so of course, and they get all the credit. So I was concerned as to how the Korean War Veterans Memorial, my little project, of which there was a sculptor and myself, I did the mural, and the architects of record, how we are going to make this look as be and exist as part of a community. And the community was the Lincoln Memorial, and I think the Lincoln Memorial is one of the finest memorials I have ever seen built anywhere, as well as the Vietnam Memorial, which is probably the one memorial that has healed a nation in the midst of all of the problems that this country went through internally, with recognizing the war and commemorating the war in all kinds of way, and the service of the men and women that served over there, in not even talking about the problems of the drugs and this and that and the other thing that came out of it, and then all the way back to the Washington Monument, because the Washington Monument, those three became the central folks, and those three are the central items with, if you add the World War II memorial to that, are the memorials on the National Mall that had to do with wars, as opposed to has to do with leadership. So one had to deal with the other, in contrast architecturally, but it also had to deal with the nature of how they were evolved and what their history was.
So, and, you know, it's interesting that I have visited, many of your listeners here will have visited all of those memorials. Few of us will have thought about the difference between the sculpture and the building. Maybe you have, because you have an aesthetic sensibility, but I think of the Lincoln Memorial as a unitary structure. Washington Monument is separate because there is no sculpture, but the others are in fact combinations of an architectural piece and then a sculpture. And the Korean War Veterans Memorial and the Vietnam Memorial also have this different, you know, sculptures of soldiers, and then the mural in your case, or the wall in the Vietnam case, that is the relationship between the two, and the fact that they're different artists. I wouldn't have immediately realized that's a really interesting, your relationship with the sculptor. Frank Gaylord, is that correct?
Frank Gaylord.
Yes. And even in the Lincoln Memorial, the person who designed the building was not the person who designed the sculpture, did the sculpture, that type of thing. I was unaware of that dynamic, shall we say.
But it's very important in that particular case, in the case of Lincoln, it's very important because those two guys worked together. In the case of the Jefferson, they were lifetimes apart.
Okay.
That the architect who put the structure together and said that there should be a sculpture in the middle of it didn't know who the sculptor was. And the sculptor didn't know who the architect was because they had died in the intervening time. Mm-hmm. And there was like a war came up, a Second World War came up in the time. So we didn't really see. As a matter of fact, the original sculpture of Jefferson was really a papier-mâché sculpture. And then it turned into a piece of bronze only after the Second World War. But in my estimation, whereas Lincoln looks absolutely crystal clear, proper,
right,
and
right,
just
right.
glows. He glows
sitting there, yes,
sitting there in all his whiteness, looking out over the reflecting pool, and to and Vietnam to the left, and Korea to the right, and World War II beyond. He is just the right size. Well, it turns out that he was probably originally designed was half the size he eventually ended up being. So it was, and they had this conversation back and forth between these two guys. I had a similar conversation with Frank, although not as detailed as that, because they were two different pieces, mm-hmm. of different kinds of work. The important thing here in this way that I wanted from is I wanted people to come to that mural and to be able to see the soldier who was in Korea in 1950 and 1953, and see how different or really how similar they are to the youth of today. And then 50 years from now, 50 years, and I'm thinking of, I would have something standing 50 years from now that I did, is a truly amazing thought, that somebody could see what the people looked like at that particular time. And then I was given this gift by God Almighty, because I didn't plan it. And somehow or another, because of the nature of the engraving and how engraved at night, and then and the light falling on it makes the wall disappear. So consequently, what you see are ghost-like images.
Images, yeah.
And you see, and it just looks surreal, absolutely surreal. It's like an amazing gift that I was given.
And so the memorial itself, another thing that one have thought about, the people come and see your work, and they think, wow, that was interesting design, interesting implementation. One thing that a history of the construction of the work shows, that the terms of the engagement changed. There was an architect of record. There's a committee. You have chapters or paragraphs, extensive discussions of the committee. A committee made this memorial, and one raises the issue that committees may have made lots of memorials. You only see the final thing, but of course the committee changed, the mandates change, and so you're moving, the goalposts are moving a little bit as you're trying to play the game.
I didn't have that much of a problem. I had a major problem when the principal of the foundation that put this together, a four-star general, died. And he died on Christmas Day, and we hadn't finished the design yet. Mm-hmm. And the agreements that I had with him as to what he wanted to see, and he agreed with me, which is nice to have, you know, to have the principal guy agree with what you want to do. I wanted all of the portraits. There's, you know, something like over 2,000 portraits on that wall. I wanted them to show essentially just the face of the person and what his occupation maybe was. And that's what General Stilwell wanted as well. General Stilwell died. And then the executive director came and thought that most of his people were thinking that they wanted to see all the implements of war. They wanted to see the helicopters. They wanted to see the aircraft. They wanted mm-hmm. to see the tanks. They wanted to see, which was difficult. And it was, and for me, because it was a major change if we did something like that, a major change as well, because I didn't think it was the right thing to do.
Aesthetically,
aesthetically, intellectually, because this is not a recruiting poster. Mm-hmm. This is a poster about the nature of service and who has given this service. And they're simply men and women of different ages, of different cultures and so forth, that were all on that wall. And eventually I was able to work it through, at least in my own mind. So there are some degrees of, there are some aircraft and so forth, but they're very faint, uh-huh. they're very much in the background. So we can work it. But things do change, and yeah. you just have to live with that change. I'm not so sure what some of those problems are. I'll tell you one major change. You probably, very few people would know this, but the Washington Monument, an extraordinary plinth in the middle of the air, so well defining, you know, very few things that define what Washington is, or where it is, or the nature of the name of the place. You see that, you say Washington, D.C. The original design for it was that plinth and a colonnade around it with General Washington in a chariot drawn by horses in front of him. And there was a lot of question as to who you call Washington, whether he's king or whether he's sir,
Roman emperor,
all kinds of different. Yeah. All of that was all ironed out. And eventually one thing led to another because of the politics and also probably the ownership and of the ideas at the time as to what they finally decided upon. They just forgot about the sculpture. Yeah. And just stayed.
Fortunately.
And then they had somebody, they had another group come in to take another look at the foundation, because mostly that area and so forth is swampland. So they had to do a lot of reconstruction of the underpinnings. The proportions of the memorial, the monument, changed a bit. The unfortunate thing is that all the way at the top, there's a little apex, kind of a four-sided pyramid.
Yeah.
It's made out of titanium. No, it's made out of aluminum, which was one of the most expensive metals at the time when this was built. And on it is the inscription of who were the architects and who were the benefactors of this, that, and the other thing. They never gave the original architect credit, which is unfortunate. I gave him credit in my book.
Yeah, you mentioned several times that you and Frank were dropped off of at various ceremonies acknowledging the inauguration of the monument. I think there were two separate episodes. In both episodes, you and Frank were left off the paperwork, given credit, which I found stunning. So I'm glad you're able to properly document that historically.
We were lucky because for one, various other reasons. So President Clinton was looking for my name, who happened to know my name, not if ands or buts about it, and he was trying to find the sculptor's name. He said, I knew your name. He apologized to me for not mentioning my name, but he didn't want to mention my name unless he could tell everybody the sculptor's name, but he couldn't find the sculptor's name. He couldn't understand, why are these guys not doing that?
Right, the committee. I was expecting a history of the Korean War Veterans Monument, and fascinating. Some of the technical stuff is also very interesting. Maybe we should go there first before we get back to some of the other topics I want to raise. And the technology that you used to make those panels with the images of the soldiers is not simple. It was a very elaborate process that you describe. Maybe you can summarize it, because I think people will find that. I found it interesting, and I wasn't expecting it to be such an
You mean the process. Transference of the images?
Right? Yes, where you got the images from the archives, and then how you put that onto to the stone, and then in Minnesota, and get that over here, back to D.C. and so forth.
I think what we worked out a state of the art at that time, and this was in the 50s, although I think that they had good leadings to it. I figured that if you could print a photograph that's on a halftone in a black and white newspaper, and either print a small photograph big or a big photograph small, that somehow or another, the technology of taking a dot and imprinting it with a color could be transferred into engraving that dot into a piece of stone. So once you engrave that dot into a piece of stone, you put another of the dots around it,
right?
You can build a photograph.
Right.
And that's essentially what all these photographs were. As a matter of fact, we developed a whole different dot pattern that would be consistent with the granule structure of the stone. So it looks like what the dots were that were engraved were really part of the stone. So there's a visual kind of context.
And how did you find this quarry in that particular stone in Minnesota?
I think the quarry is out in California. It was the manufacturers were Cold Spring Granite, and they had a whole different number of quarries, and they're the ones that had the quarry. So they showed all the different kinds of stones that they had, and we chose the stone we wanted.
And then the transference occurred there through this new process, and then everything was shipped from
Minnesota. They had phenomenal people. So the process is that you take this photograph and you can put it onto a photosensitive rubber plate, and then expose that plate to a dissolving process so that the dots disappear or vice versa. So consequently, you then have a piece of rubber that can be applied to a piece of stone, and all the dots are staying in place. And you just wash this down so that the adhesive is eliminated, and then you spray it with a sand. You can sandblast it. It's called grit blasting. But today you'll see this. You'll see it applied in many ways on glass windows in restaurants and various other places.
Well, you have etchings of fine etchings of it. So yeah. Fascinating. And then transfer, you had 2,000 photos-ish from the National Archives that you sorted through.
Yeah.
And so their images.
There's probably more. There's probably easily 10,000.
That you started with.
Yeah.
And you transfer this, transfer it to stone, and then bring those stones to D.C.
Well, they were all applied in big blocks. So, they're out in the... these big, monstrously big stone sheds that manipulate these large, big blocks of stone. It's just absolutely phenomenal and noisy. There's so much noise that you could be there for 2 hours and be totally fatigued just from the impact of the noise.
And you went out many times to oversee the transference?
Many times, yeah.
So it comes together, the memorial comes together, and then, as you said, events lead you to want to write the history, but you also put into the history not only memorials, not only D.C., not only the personalities and aesthetics of Washington and Jefferson and Vietnam, but also Lewis Nelson appears. And it turns out, even though I've known you for 30 years, Lewis, I picked up lots of tidbits there that I knew you flew helicopters. I didn't know you really flew helicopters, though.
Yeah.
So you are a very interesting person. You have had an extremely interesting life. It still is going on robustly. But there was a fair amount of your personal history. And, it's part memoir. The book is part memoir. And that's great because you're lived a life that's worth documenting. I don't know if you want to tell a couple of details, but your own military history is not irrelevant to what occurs. You're a design person from day one, but you end up in the military before returning to design. And that is a very interesting chapter of your life from my perspective. For a person, I've known you as a design person, and that part of your life to me is very consistent. The extensive military history was less so.
I guess when I look back at some of the writing of it, it became more apparent to me historically than anything else, largely because I was fortunate enough. I was born and raised here in New York. We were far from a wealthy family. As a matter of fact, Dad worked hard. Mom was an immigrant. I'm second generation. It was a Norwegian family, and Dad decided that he was going to become. He was a photographer. He loved photography as a kid himself. He decided to become an electrical engineer. He, because of the nature of money and the nature of family and so forth, he never finished high school. So he was self-educated, so forth. That created another set of just circumstances, just to just put that to the side. When I was born, I luckily was able to go to one of the better high schools in New York. There was maybe three or four major good. I went to a place called Brooklyn Tech. I was offered all kinds of opportunities and specializations of degrees and so forth. I decided, because it seemed interesting, that industrial design was offered. This is back in 1950, and industrial design as a profession wasn't even really very well known at that particular time, but there was they were educating people. I chose that. And I eventually went to the Pratt Institute, which was just down the street in Brooklyn. It was probably one of the leading design schools in the United States. However, it wasn't at the to go and have an education at that time at even a place called Pratt was not expensive, but it still was not cheap. And we barely had any kind of money at that time as the family was concerned. I worked my butt off in the summer times and whenever I could to have jobs delivering mail at Christmas time, which people did at that particular time. So they had ROTC there. So I decided to go into ROTC one because.
What year is this roughly?
This is 1954.
So right after the war, the Korean War has come to an end.
That's right. 1954.
The ceasefire has started.
The draft still goes on. I decided in order to maintain an education and not be drafted, I would take ROTC and take it all the way through. So I graduated with honors in design and honors in the military. And I was committed to a 2-year stint in the Army. And I chose to go to armor school. Somewhere around that time also because I was a fairly good student in ROTC, they offered me a 3-year a regular Army commission, which I thought might be helpful. It would cost one more year of my time, but I might have some other opportunities. That would be good because I would be a career officer.
Right.
So I took it. And lo and behold, an opportunity came up to go to flight school. I was one of the first commission officers to go through flight school for helicopters. And that was in 58, so 1959. And then all of a sudden, I found out that I was in a top organization, the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. And we had all kinds of stuff to do. And then the Berlin Wall was built. And consequently, Jack Kennedy sent me and 40,000 other people over to Germany at that time in a buildup. And
you're flying helicopters and training others to fly helicopters at that time.
And I'm flying, yeah. At that, and now we're in Germany doing it. And at that same time, the Cuban Missile Blockade came up. So, and I decided somewhere in the middle of all that to resign my commission, go back to graduate school.
But you did spend some time on the front lines of the Cold War, provided a context of military service. Thank you for your service, by the way.
But what had happened is that there's a whole series of things that all of a sudden happened as a result of that, not because of it, but just as a result. I spent this time in the Army. And then before you know it, I'm looking at various things and there's opportunities that come up like to be considered to do the Korean War Veterans Memorial. And then after that, to design the Dag Hammarskjöld Medal for the United Nations, which is given to peacekeepers who have lost their lives in the peacekeeping operations at the United Nations. And then a number of these other memorials that just pop up, it just became part of my life, as well as designing skis for Head and no-nonsense pantyhose and all kinds of other things.
Do you want to describe a little bit of the non-military design? Because I think, this is called Burying the Lead. Everyone listening to this, and pretty much everyone in modern society has seen Lewis Nelson work. They just don't know it until now. They're about to learn what they see maybe 50 times a day that is your work. Take it away, Lewis.
I worked it out and I was told that probably 4 million people every hour.
That sounds about right.
Look at a food package. Yeah. And on the food package, they will look at a little chart that says nutrition facts. And I was one of the principal people that put that program into existence at the Food and Drug Administration. So
So a lot of interesting design and an interesting life. As I say, the book called Mosaic, War Monument Mystery by Lewis Nelson is just out. Please, it is available on through your booksellers. I think you'll find it a very interesting read. Lewis, War Monument Mystery, the mystery part, just because it was complicated to put together, you put the word mystery in the title because?
It's always a mystery there. It's okay. how it moves through from one place to another.
Yeah.
People have found it that way anyway. And I thought it was, after saying war, but the book is more than war and monuments. Although it is a good opening to the whole discussion about monuments today that we're talking about, whether they are in the South or in any place else in the United States, and the reasons why people want to pull certain things down, and reasons why they ought not to. But that's another story. Another book.
That's another book, and as a historian, I have very strong views on that. Let's save that for the next episode, our next conversation, when we discuss your next book. Again, Lewis Nelson, thank you so much for being on the show. It's a fascinating book, and I encourage our listeners to get a copy. And it's been a real pleasure catching up with you today.
Daniel, thank you very much. It's so good to be here and to have this discussion with you. I appreciate it. And thank you, everyone.